This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
By popular demand, Place to Be Nation Wrestling returns to the Dirty South for Talkin' WCW, an episodic wrestler showcase designed to educate, evaluate, and entertain, with matches spanning the intimate stage of Techwood Studios to the heights of Space Mountain. Talkin' WCW presents the best, worst, and most surreal offerings from World Championship Wrestling. So cast your gaze to the Turnertron with hosts Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, and Greg Phillips.
Hi, welcome to Talkin' WCW. My name is Jennifer Smith. I'm here with the IBS to my IED, Tim Capel. How you doing, Tim?
On that note, I don't know where to go with
that
one.
I always like it when I pop you, and I'm just trying to move on.
I mean, I have to sell it, of course, but it leaves me a little bit speechless, although it is apropos, I believe. So I guess the Crohn's disease to my IBS.
LSU to your IED.
The LFG, there we go.
There you
go. The man
who sees... I made it bad already.
This is what the people expect. The man whose seat is higher than the rest, Greg Phillips. Greg, oh man. We've had a bit of a hiatus, right?
We took the month of
January. Well, we took the month of December off and ended up inadvertently taking the month of January off. It's the great resignation, folks. This is, you know, nobody wants to work anymore. And that includes podcasters. But no, we love doing the show. We've missed doing the show, and we're very glad to be back. I say, speaking for myself anyway. Greg, do you feel the same?
I do. I do. It would be bad if I didn't. But no, I do. I do feel the same. Talking WCW back in full force in 2022. Well, I assume full force. We might suck this year. Who knows?
I doubt it.
You know, but we're back nonetheless. And I think that we've had a couple months to recharge our WCW batteries, to get back in the swing of things, to recapture our essence, to realize the beauty of life. Am I right?
Mm. Yeah, something like that.
A lot of pressure for WCW there, Greg.
Oh, well, this is why we do a WCW podcast.
What is WCW if not a microcosm of life?
Yeah, pretty much.
Ooh. Wow, that was deep. Yeah, that's
I know.
Well, I've been studying a lot of Eastern philosophy in the 2 months since our previous episode.
It shows. Jenny... I was, I guess, on deck for our pick this month, and I came up with Eddie Guerrero, who I feel like, I don't know, I don't want to say we're late getting to, because we checked off a lot of big names early on. Now we're in sort of the mid-card vanilla midget tier of WCW, but it gives us some tremendous matches to look at. And so I think we came up with three really different but excellent in their own right picks. And I believe mine is actually first, if we're going chronologically here.
I believe so. It's funny, when I asked for recommendations for Eddie Guerrero and WCW, I had a fucking slew of them, and
yeah.
A lot of the times when I ask for recs, I get like three. So I feel like that's very much indicative of him as a wrestler.
Yeah, and some of these guys are tough, let's face it, because we remember them as great characters. We remember maybe a handful, like you said, of great matches they may have had, but WCW as a promotion, when you think about it, isn't around for the longest span of time, especially if we're going, if we're really going for that, that like 1980, so include like Crockett, through 2000, that's still just a 20 year span. Mm-hmm. And not many wrestlers spent their entire careers working WCW or NWA. And Eddie's one of them. He comes in, fall of 1995. So really just shortly after Nitro launches, right? And he's there through, the end of 99, leaving in early 2000s with, the rest of the radicals, if you will. But his first match on Nitro was with a guy who also debuted at that same time, Chris Benoit. So I believe that was the first match for both of them in WCW. Correct me if I'm wrong. At least first televised match.
Well, Benoit had worked a few matches in like 90s.
Well, yes, in the earlier 90s.
But in the new run, yes, that was the introduction of that. That's the first time I had ever seen either guy.
Yeah, as a contracted talent in the Monday Night Wars era. So and that was a nice little showcase for them. You know, Nitro had a lot of buzz at the time, being the new live primetime show for WCW. At that point, they were just running an hour on TNT. But to have these just world-class athletes go out there that nobody's really familiar with but could put on awesome matches – I think that's one of the ways that Eric Bischoff wanted to differentiate Nitro from their competition. You know, they had a lot of just international cred, guys from around the world who would go out there with no real character, a lot of times no real storyline even, just put on a banger of a match and really surprise some people. And Eddie Guerrero was a pretty big component of that formula, especially in his early years, as we're going to see. So,
those early months of Nitro, you know, you obviously had the main event storylines with Hogan that they were building the show around, but the undercard of that show was very much heavily focused on three guys: Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, and Dean Malenko, in various combinations wrestling each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some awesome matches. That match between Benoit and Eddie, that was the first match for both guys on Nitro, changed my wrestling fan life. I had never seen anything like that style of wrestling before. And so it really, like, you know, it opened my eyes to a totally new style of wrestling. And both guys became favorites of mine.
And to be clear, it's a style of wrestling you see all the time on television now, but you did not at all back then. So very different, but very influential at the same time. So we're going to kick it over to 1996 now for a match. This is – talk about no real storyline. I just kind of plucked it, as I often do, from the archives. I like looking for these hidden gems, these matches that people have probably seen but don't necessarily remember. And this may give them a chance to rediscover. It is from the May 20th, 1996 Nitro, and it is Eddie Guerrero taking on the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. Story such as it is, as much as I could gather here, was that so this is the Nitro coming off of Slamboree, the pay-per-view, the night before, which that Slamboree in 1996 was the last edition, Greg, of the infamous Battle Bowl, as we know it, the
Lethal Lottery.
Bowl, with the Lethal / Urethral Lottery. Yes. And clearly in a very shoot style, you know, Urethral Lottery, by pure chance, you know, Ric Flair draws Randy Savage as his random tag team partner. And they're going to be taking on Eddie Guerrero and his completely drawn at random tag team partner, Arn Anderson, Flair's longtime running buddy in the Four Horsemen.
One of them.
Yeah. So that's going to go badly, at Slamboree. basically Arn is going to turn on Eddie more or less immediately. drop him with a DDT, and he and Flair are going to lay out Eddie and Savage and leave together. So they're not really interested in advancing in the Battle Bowl. I can't imagine why. So you see where that lethal lottery can come in useful sometimes for advancing storylines, at least. Anyway, Eddie is here now, out for revenge. Going to be taking on Flair, who is not the world champion here. This is no title on the line or anything, but also all that not that far removed from being a champion. This is sort of Flair's last hurrah in some ways as like a serious heel contender in WCW, I feel like, before NWO just runs wild on everything and kind of turns everybody's face by default.
He's also sporting some of the shortest hair of his career, at least since that bowl cut in 1990. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is bowl cut slash soccer mom slash bus driver, school bus driver.
Jamie Lee Curtis, Ric Flair.
Jamie Lee Curtis, Ric Flair. Thank you.
Johnny Knoxville, Ric Flair.
I was going to say, Johnny. How does that come up again? Anyway.
It's genius, that's why.
By the way, this is, if you want to see the Ric Flair, I have to bring it up every time, the Ric Flair lipoma in its full glory. 1996 is your year, because boy, is that thing, you know, looking to establish its own zip code there on Flair's back. It's really prominent. Anyway,
it's
to the match.
Lipoma. I never knew. I had it for 20 years. They never told me.
Rick, was it a lipoma or was it a cyst?
It wasn't a cyst. I'll tell you that right now. I know what a cyst is. Ah, I've banged a few cysts in my day.
Oh, shit. Welcome back to Talking WCW, everybody. Okay, so we're going to start with your kind of basic collar and elbow tie up here. Leads to a headlock takeover by Eddie. But Flair manages to leverage Eddie into a pin on a couple of occasions there. Eddie hangs on. Flair managed to escape. Knocks Eddie to the mat with a shoulder block, but then he eats a drop kick on the second attempt. Eddie goes right back to that headlock, but Flair knees out of it this time to break. Goes for another attempt at the shoulder tackle, but that gets thwarted by Eddie with a drop toe hold, and Eddie quickly transitions right back into that headlock, showing off his kind of mat wrestling bona fides here, hanging right in with Flair. So Flair sends Eddie into the corner, unloads with the chops. Eddie answers with a flurry of right hands and chops of his own. It's kind of a chop fest here at this point. Mm-hmm. Back body drops and a pair of drop kicks send Flair to the outside. We get a funny segment here where Flair then retrieves a chair from his own VIP table. It was a great fixture of those early Nitros, was Flair at the at the table with all the food and the champagne. Just one of those nice touches that people forget, I think, from early Nitros. But anyway, he has the chair taken from him by Randy Anderson. Flair then throws a fit at ringside. But back in the ring, Eddie pounds away on Flair. And he steps outside the ring to mock the Nature Boy. He's clearly getting under Flair's skin, you know, this young upstart. So Eddie then chops away at Flair in the corner. And this leads us to I took note of this as a rarely seen reverse Flair flop by Flair, who marches out of the corner as he often does. But then he kind of spins around, does this 180, falls face first. So it's a flop that completely defies physics, but
really didn't really fit the, you know, Eddie. I think the first chop that he hit him was stung him more than the one that caused the flop.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's kind of a delayed sell too, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, I don't know if I was the only one, when Flair went out to retrieve the chair, I swear, I was about to lose it because I thought he was going to walk up the aisle and do the flop in the aisle.
Yes, which is amazing.
Yeah, one of my favorite spots ever in wrestling, but he didn't do it.
Just marches up the aisle and falls.
I thought he was going to destroy that table, so that was just me.
I love the little angry jump up and
yeah,
like Yosemite Sam.
Yeah, just great character work. So we get, after this nonsense, we get a thumb to the eye by Flair, because of course we do. And that allows him to briefly regain the advantage. But Eddie's going to come right back with a pair of lariats and goes up top for a sunset flip, giving us our first real near fall of the match. Flair then begs off in the corner, as he does, but that's really just a way to sucker Eddie in for an inverted atomic drop. And Flair punishes Eddie with elbows and knee drops, chops on him in the corner. And Eddie then, in a demonstration, I guess, of his athletic prowess, he kips right up after Flair chops him down. And then he gets a two count off of a backslide, follows up with a small package. So we're getting some near falls now. The drama is really escalating here. But Flair cuts off the momentum with a belly-to-back suplex. Eddie, though, manages to turn the tables on Flair. He hits a single-leg takedown, transitions into a figure four. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
But Flair, too close to the ropes, and manages to reach the ropes, bails out of the ring. Eddie goes up to the top, but he wipes out, just hits it chest first on the guardrail. So back in the ring, Flair is going to press this advantage with a hanging vertical suplex, very nicely done. But Eddie is going to escape with a back. Well, he manages to escape a back suplex and hit a cross body, sends Flair up and over to the outside. Another great Flair spot there. Eddie slingshots him back in the ring, gets a sunset flip, but Flair punches him right to the mat. Flair corners Eddie against the turnbuckle, but Eddie has an answer with a big tornado DDT. Awesome of Flair to take that as well as he does.
Yeah.
Just seems like the type of move that, I mean, not that Flair can't sell it, but it's not exactly old school wrestling, right?
What the hell is this? As Eddie was setting that up, I was just thinking to myself, what weird, awkward way is Rick going to take this bump? And he didn't.
Exactly.
Look, it's exactly right.
Yeah. Textbook. And same thing with the Eddie does that springboard Hurricane Rana, and once again it's a little bit awkward, but I think that was more of a timing thing than anything else. But that's got Flair rattled, and Eddie scoop slams the Nature Boy right in the middle of the ring, positioning him perfectly for a textbook Eddie Guerrero frog splash. Looks beautiful. But Eddie apparently injures his knee on the impact. He cannot follow up. Flair manages to recover. He goes to work right away on that injured leg of Eddie Guerrero. Eddie is trying to fight it off in a great spot. He's holding Flair's leg up as Flair is trying to bring it down to get that figure four locked in. Flair manages to do it. And in a kind of interesting finish, Flair manages to get the win. Not by submitting Eddie, but pinning him in the figure four. Eddie was so racked with pain in this submission that he allowed himself to get pinned, his shoulders to the mat, while Flair gets the assist on the outside from Woman, who was holding his hands, which, you know, again, the physics of that are a little bit logic-defying, but this is wrestling. And so we get a hard-fought victory for Flair. Just great back-and-forth match, pure exhibition, but type of shit that Nitro is just known for. This is just really their bread and butter. Eddie Guerrero and Flair have not a ton of matches over the course of their career, but a few encounters, mostly in WCW. One I could think of in WWF in, 2002? I kind of think this is the best of the three. Not that I've watched them all recently, but this was one I just had forgotten about.
Didn't they have one on WCW?
They did. They have one on Road Wild.
Yeah, this one's better than that, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. This is better than their WCW pay-per-view match. And, I mean, it's got to be better than that WWF match, a few years later. But this one really took me by surprise. I didn't think I would end up picking this for the show, but I watched it and found myself getting increasingly drawn in. And it's just a great example of what an Eddie Guerrero early in his WCW run could do, even without having the strong character that we're gonna
right
come to know him for. I mean, this is like plucky babyface Eddie Guerrero, which
this is about as bland as Eddie Guerrero ever was from a character yep. standpoint. And yet, what I wanted to remark upon is he comes into the company in fall of 95, and mm-hmm. this is spring of 96. And even though he's got no real character to speak of, just on the strength of his wrestling and his innate charisma and his innate attachment to ability to connect with audiences, he's over as a babyface. Yeah. I mean, he's yeah. getting any chance at various points in this match. It's not a lot of times if the crowd doesn't care about the babyface, they'll just chant against the heel rather than
exactly.
chant for the babyface. But in this case, they chant for Eddie at various points in the match, and that's a testament to how good he was, that he was able to get over without really having any definable character traits other than plucky underdog good guy, you know?
Who wrestles really well, yeah.
yep.
And I think it also, you know, it gives Flair a damn good match late in his mm-hmm. career.
Yep.
I'm sure, I mean, not to say, far be it for me to suggest Eddie carried Flair in this. I think if anything, Flair is probably calling the match, but
yeah, it's a Flair match. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. But I mean, Eddie is totally game for everything. And Flair is extremely cooperative. Yeah. It's a real kind of 50-50 match up to the finish. Which that's a very giving thing for mm-hmm. A main eventer in WCW like Ric Flair with, you know, this young guy who's been there less than a year.
That was one of my notes, too, for this match was how just fucking good Flair is. But I was trying to look at it from the Eddie point of view. And mm-hmm. it's real hard when you love Flair like I do. And
oh, yeah.
Really
yeah.
fucking good in this. And so I just tried to, like, think of it that way. I just kept getting so enamored with Flair during it.
And I don't blame you. This could just as easily be a... If we did another Ric Flair episode, I could pick this match just as easily,
for sure.
I feel like.
For sure, but I really did love Eddie's just ability to hang with him. And the, like you said, the give and take of it. Like, I feel like they knew what they had while it was happening, and they just kept kind of building it. And
yeah.
It makes it special. Like, I mean, this is like a random Nitro, right?
totally random Nitro coming off of pay-per-view.
So
by the way, though, awesome. If you like, I found myself, and Greg, you probably do the same thing when you watch just matches from these random matches from Nitros, is kind of find yourself getting sucked in, right?
Mm-hmm.
With
yes.
all stuff on the periphery.
Absolutely.
And I definitely found that happening after this match was over, because there's a lot of storyline stuff involving Flair at this time. They're already doing the kind of the hard sell for Great American Bash, which is that 96 Great American Bash is like an all-time WCW.
Yeah, it's one of the best pay-per-views that are.
Yeah, so they're building up like the Kevin Green and the Mongo stuff, and I was like, eh, let me just watch these next few segments. So after the match, and this has nothing to do with Eddie Guerrero, by the way. I'm just putting it out there. After the match, Flair cuts a promo, talks about how much fun he's having with Miss Elizabeth now by his side, spending all of Macho Man Randy Savage's money, who was mm-hmm. suspended from WCW, by the way, so he can't even get into the building. So that leads to a cutaway with Savage basically getting into it with Mean Gene and a bunch of security guards trying to break down the door to this arena. And Flair is just eating it up. He then goes and joins Bobby Heenan and Eric Bischoff on commentary for the rest of the show. And let me tell you, Flair on commentary is a fucking treat. He is just, especially in 96, where he's still in that mode. He's still really feeling it. And he has them basically bring the VIP shit over to the main announce table. So he and Bob are like toasting champagne, like cutting up on everybody. Eric Bischoff even is kind of getting into it. It is an absolute delight. And it goes into like a Sting and Luger versus Faces of Fear match. So you get Barbarian and Ming now taking on Sting and Luger, who I believe are the tag champs. And again, this just random Nitro, hell of a fucking match. Again, Flair is awesome on commentary, basically doing color throughout the rest of the show. And it's just like, God, this is, you know, this is why wrestling was so hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially why WCW in particular was so hot. Even pre-NWO, not for much longer, but, you know, this May 96 time period, they were riding high. So check out this old night. I guess that all that is to say, I recommend not only this match, but the entire episode of this Nitro.
It really is amazing. Like looking back, how good Nitro, because in your mind, you kind of think back of, okay, the NWO was the changing point of where everything, you know, the show was pretty much awesome for the next half, whatever. But when Hogan wasn't there, Nitro was really good already. Before the end, the only difference was when the NWO came along, suddenly there was a story through line for the entire show, and Hogan was more interesting. So you have to deal with like the Dungeon of Doom and the, you know, the alliance to end Hulkamania and all that. So in addition to these great, but think about it, this time you get these great matches. You had Ric Flair being entertaining every week. You had a great tag division at that time, I thought. Luger and Sting and the Steiners and the Road Warriors and the and Public Enemy and the Nasty Boys and Harlem Heat and all those guys.
True. And for a 90-minute show, which Nitro pretty much was at the time, they were about to go to 2 hours. You watch this on the network or the Peacock, take out those commercials, it knocks it down to just a little bit over an hour. That's a nice, easy watch right there.
So, yeah, we still get two commercial breaks in between in this.
Yes, game. We do. Yes.
So
we do.
I mean, it goes
for, house ads, if you will.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. It goes for a good clip, but honestly, you don't mind any of it. Like, you don't mind a minute of it. It never is boring ever. I get a little interested too, and I always like. I guess I'm sidetracking us again from Eddie. Poor Eddie.
All good. Oh.
I feel bad.
This is the show. I mean.
Yeah. So like, Woman and Elizabeth. With Flair, and I'm watching them, and they just, it was very sad. Like, I just felt very sad. And that's probably the first time that I felt that way, but I managed to look away from Ric Flair for a little bit, and I looked at the ladies, and they just seem like it's just a struggle. Like, I just had all these emotions about the sister wives ringside.
Oh, God. The sister wives.
So,
Was in this mix, too. So, it's, three sister wives, basically, with the Horsemen, 96. I totally get what you mean.
But I feel like that, it never fazed Eddie. Like, you know, he didn't fuck with any of them ringside, and they didn't fuck with him. And he just got to work this match with Flair and is fucking awesome in it.
Yeah, and I think for Elizabeth in particular, this probably was a struggle, only because she had gotten out of wrestling, and they, made her an offer she couldn't refuse to come back. She's probably relieved that she's not working with Savage anymore at this point, but still maybe not her.
But they still have to bring up Savage, you know, constantly.
All the time.
On commentary.
Yeah.
And they are. I mean, they just are. And anyway,
so. They did look amazing at that time, though.
Yeah. I mean, they both look amazing, but. Yeah. I guess that's just like the kind of the dark side of like learning more about this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at that match and you realize that three of the four parties involved in that match are no longer with us.
Right. I mean, not to like bring down the mood or anything, but that's just something I wanted to.
That's part and parcel of talking about any wrestling from that era there's going to be an element of tragedy into it most of the time.
And I was surprised that Flair won this. I was definitely expecting Eddie to get it out, even with the ladies there. Like, I'm like, I don't know. Over the course of the match, I just sort of bought into the fact that Eddie was going to win this. And then when he didn't, I was like, well, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, Eddie was so good in this match with,
yeah,
with his fired up comebacks. Mm-hmm. So when it came time, I mean, the thing about the key to a babyface having a great match against Flair is they've got to, he's going to call comebacks for him and they've got to be there. They've got to mm-hmm. be fired up and they've got to be able to get the crowd invested in their energy. And Eddie really fires up on Rick a few times and mm-hmm. like lays into him with chops and starts throwing those punches to the head and Rick will bump off of him sometimes. It was really good stuff. Eddie was a perfect foil in this match, showing that fire that he would become, that, you know, Latino heat, shall we say, that he would become known for later on, in his career. He's showing that as early as 1996 in this match, that ability to show that anger and that charisma and that energy that makes you believe that, hey, this guy might pull the upset here. He's going against a 13 time at that point world champion. He might actually pull it off here. Mm-hmm. So yeah, great job by Eddie there on helping you buy into that. And also Flair, I feel like we've spent most of the match talking
about Eddie,
but he does a great job of feeding Eddie and giving Eddie in this match to make it look super competitive, which Flair was always good about that. Even though say what you will about him, he always gave to his opponents and made them look as good as he could make them look. If it, you know, sometimes he didn't mesh with the person, but he was always calling things to try to get the guy's offense over. And he certainly did that with Eddie, and Eddie was there every step of the way.
And I will say we do see some character flourishes from Eddie, this, you know, where he's mocking Flair with the strut mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. just little things like that, that it's, you know, it's not going to get him super over if he isn't there already, but it's something to connect for the crowd to connect with.
Also, I want to talk a little bit about the frog splash, like,
okay,
as a move in general, because like it's sort of odd and silly looking.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to think about it.
Yes, it's a move that, far from being like a wrestling finisher, it's like something you would do at the pool, like off the diving board when you're in like a splash contest or something.
That was my exact comp. somehow he makes it not look like that, and
right.
I don't understand that.
I can't. I know it's. And there's lots of variations on the frog splash. You know, you've got Eddie's, which is extremely elegant, for lack of a better word. He really just rides him down into the end of the opponent.
His was a very good long-distance frog splash.
Yes, distance is key, I feel like.
Whereas you've got RVD, who really goes for height.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And D'Lo Brown would do sort of the, I don't know, like,
the between the legs frog splash.
Yes, the swoop would. he had an interesting form for his.
He went full frog on that.
Yeah,
fully.
Would you argue that his actually looks the most like a frog?
Like a frog.
it does. Yeah. It's probably the one that I have most closely imitated. And I got to tell you, Eddie hurting his knee on the landing.
Yeah.
Is very true to life, because I've done that in a, I was drunk, mind you, but in a rather shallow, I came down, I did it off the diving board, but I kind of overshot the deep end of the pool. So I guess you could say I went for distance too. and I came down really hard and more of the shallow part of the pool. At least there's enough water to somewhat lessen the blow, because I came down right on my left knee, and I this is an injury that sounds hilarious but isn't. I ruptured a bursa sac.
It is hilarious, sorry.
Yeah, which is basically just it's kind of like, I guess they're kind of like discs in your neck, but they're in your knees and I guess other joints, but just a fluid filled sac that the fluid shot right out of, and surgery.
You busted your sack. We get it.
I busted my sack. I busted my sack. We can say.
He ruptured a disc, which.
He ruptured a disc, which I got into my birth sack. Ric Flair trying to say versus Santa.
That was what ended Arn's career. Arn told me, he said, "Rick, my bursa sack's broken." I said, but he wasn't laughing. Oh, it was terrible.
Oh, man. I love these Nature Boy run-ins. I will say, if anyone has experienced this injury or experiences that injury in the future, it's not one that requires surgery. The sack will reinflate on its own.
Good.
It's got to heal up and then it will slowly reinflate. It just takes some time. In my case, it was about 3-4 weeks before it felt, but it didn't like it wasn't agonizing pain that whole time. It just gradually got better.
That's certainly better than rupturing a disc which fragmented into your spinal column.
Yeah, fully. Yeah.
Yeah, certain form of
that didn't happen.
You do. So yes.
All right.
Subject of bursa sacks.
Uh-huh.
Oh yes, frog splash imitation. Yes. I imitated the Eddie and D'Lo frog splashes. I never attempted the RVD frog splash.
Yeah. I think weight is sort of a big impediment to height. Certainly in my case. So couldn't really pull that one out.
Gravity and whatnot.
Yeah. Fan of gravity in general and certainly
sucks.
Gravity can fuck off, y'all.
Totally.
Agreed.
Just ask clean in the 70s.
Yes. It's a distasteful joke, but it popped me.
That's what we're
I feel like Rick's an okay target for distasteful jokes.
Yeah.
You know what? I think he can take it.
Yeah.
I think I'll be all right.
Don't worry about it.
So, okay, anything else on this match or the Frog Splash or Bursa Sacks or WCW Nitro in 1996?
You know, wrestling in ways in the late 90s was like a Bursa Sack. It was filling. It was filling as the 90s progressed, and then in 2001 hit the Sack Burst.
Oh. Yeah.
Frog Splash that Sack right out of here.
Yeah.
You're just bursting with metaphors tonight, Greg.
That's what I'm here for. The metaphor man.
All right. Well, very good. So our next pick, we're going to kick it over a few months later to 1997. Jenny, this was you, I do believe, at the great, not WCW, but NWO sold out from January 25th, 1997. It is in the Five Seasons Center, not Four Seasons Landscaping, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Infamously bad pay-per-view, but bad for interesting reasons, rather than boring bad. So it's oddly watchable.
Featuring the greatest PA announcer in wrestling, NWO voice guy.
NWO heel announcer. An unnamed heel announcer, but in any case, we're going to have Eddie Guerrero taking on six with the United States Championship on the line. It's a ladder match, you guys, because six is in possession of the championship. He's not, is he not the actual champion? He had just stolen it. Am I remembering?
I believe that's right.
Stolen it. Yes. I'm not 100% sure.
I believe I'm remembering that correctly. Just to basically give us an excuse to do a ladder match.
Was this the, now correct me if I'm wrong, this was the first WCW ladder match.
This is the, I mean, yes, first WCW ladder match. And they talk about sort of the history of ladder matches and how, you know, Scott Hall was the invent, not true by the way, but Scott Hall invented the ladder match and his buddy, one of his very best friends, in the Wolfpack and the NWO, six, obviously going to get some pointers from Hall going into this. So, Jenny, you can take it away from here.
So, like I said, I got a slew of recommendations for matches here, and I watched a couple, and this one I thought was interesting because, like you said, it's the NWO version of a pay-per-view, I guess. So that means commentary is fucking abysmal. Fucking Ted DiBiase and Eric Bischoff. just being absolute assholes.
Right.
For the entire time. And I was hoping that you guys could fill me in on a little bit of some of this about how weird it is that it's an NWO mm-hmm. thing, and what makes it like a bad yet good show.
Well, the and Tim, you can fill in the blanks where I'm wrong here, but essentially Bischoff had only been revealed to be a member of the NWO 2 months prior in November. Mm-hmm. They do one of the great Nitro segments, the big reveal that he's actually been the financier and the backer of the NWO. And so
and he was responsible for that reveal, Greg.
Oh, you're about to get the hot rod in here. Was the road crooked or was it straight? So they do this the great deal there. And so Bischoff.
It is a great segment. Yeah.
It's probably my favorite. Like, in all honesty, it's probably my favorite like storyline segment from Nitro. I love it.
It's great drama. Yeah.
And Piper's amazing in it. Yes. Fast forward a couple months, Bischoff, through his power as executive vice president of World Championship Wrestling, arranges for the NWO to have its own pay-per-view show. Behind the scenes, the idea was the NWO was eventually going to get its own television show. And so this is almost a little test run of sorts for what it would be or what it would look like. And so as a result of it being an NWO show, as Eric sometimes puts it on his podcast, it was giving them an excuse to throw anything at the wall to see what might stick. So they experiment with black and white video. They do a different stage, a different set. They do heel commentary and present the show. It's a grand experiment in wrestling presentation, and it ultimately served to reinforce why certain wrestling tropes exist.
That's very interesting to me, I will say.
And you know, they would trot this gimmick out a few times. Honestly, this was, I feel like they could get away with it on a pay-per-view, because it's really, I mean, yeah, it's an NWO quote unquote promoted event, but they're still NWO versus WCW stuff. It's just production wise, it's going to look very different, and have a totally different flavor from your run of the mill pay-per-views.
Mm-hmm.
The problem would be later in the year, Greg, you remember that, when they do like the NWO Saturday night, which I think on the old network, old WWE network, they had as Hidden Gem in the Hidden Gem section, which don't get me started on losing Hidden Gems on the Peacock, but whatever, beat that dead horse. And again, a very interesting experiment, but still begs the question, how would a dedicated NWO TV show work? Because they're a faction. They're all on the same team. They're not going to fight each other.
Right.
So you still got to have some WCW presence. It can't just be week after week after week NWO squashing jobbers.
The crowd's only going to cheer the cool NWO members. Everybody else.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Which is why I would argue that NWO Saturday Night actually worked a lot better than this pay-per-view did, because whereas this pay-per-view, you were listening to Eric and Ted DiBiase the entire show. If I remember correctly, NWO Saturday Night was basically Hall and Nash doing whatever the hell they wanted to do.
Yeah, you had the good comedy of the cool NWO members personality-wise.
Yeah.
And then remember, they at the end of the year, they do, of course, that infamous Nitro takeover for just the one segment, but it takes forever because you know, they've got to dismantle the entire set. They put up new NWO graphics and Chiron and all this bullshit. And that was like on the go home show for Starcade, I want to say. So it just, an infamously ill timed, bad, boring television.
They were so hot at the time that it didn't affect the buy rate at all. They did the best buy rate
right.
in the company. And even though they had the worst go home show imaginable.
Yeah, it was just terrible. But they were so bulletproof that they were like, we can do whatever. Anyway, so this was the first of those kind of 97 NWO-centric experiments. We should keep in mind that up until that Eric Bischoff reveal in late 96, the NWO was a small faction, mm-hmm. which I know a lot of people forget and sounds crazy to say, but it really was, you know, the core three, plus they had added Six, they had added the Giant. Vincent was there as like the bodyguard or whatever. But it's not like he was really wrestling. And so when, and DiBiase was there as the money man, the benefactor. But in terms of like a wrestling faction, it wasn't a lot of guys. But when Eric Bischoff was revealed as the mastermind, the mole by Roddy Piper, he issued that edict of all WCW wrestlers must convert their contracts to NWO talent now. So they made it like this. They tried to do this realistic like sport, this kind of real sports shoot angle kind of thing, but still worked within the context of professional wrestling. So that was how they got so much heat on the group, was, you know, just building them up over more and more and more, to the point that you've not only got the main event NWO guys, but you've got the B team members who have even their own separate entrance music, which we're going to hear many times on this pay-per-view.
Amazing entrance music is what they had.
See, that was like my first note, because like I was going to say, what the fuck is up with the entrance?
Amazing. Yeah.
And all it is like when Eddie comes out, all you hear is loser.
Oh my god, the greatest introduction, the Mexican jumping bean.
Yeah, Mexican jumping bean, Eddie Guerrero. I'm like, okay.
And no music, nothing.
Nothing. And it's so awkward. And the crowd, like I know I'd gathered enough to find out what had happened previous to this match where Hall and Nash lost to the Steiners. And so the crowd was like, what is happening? And then, this stuff, the entrance stuff happens. And
so
then,
just imagine that, Jenny, for 8 matches.
Yeah, so weird. It's so freaking weird. I'm going to have to end up watching this whole show. Just
in the middle of the match, you'll hear a loser.
Okay, so all of that, like super, like, negative, like, dickish vibes on the whole, this whole thing, like, works for me. Like, to me, I think it makes it super interesting and different, and that was one of the reasons why I picked it. Six is called the ultimate swinger as well.
The ultimate swinger.
Yes, he's introduced as the ultimate swinger. I mean, he also comes out to the, I never thought of Six as a NWO B team member.
No.
With his association with Hall and Nash, but he gets the B team entrance music here. So,
any thoughts on the B team entrance music? Because I hope that you love it as much as I do. Because it's the real song, the real NWO.
It's
song.
The okay. So people talk about how the main NWO theme is like from like a hardcore porno scene, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of your main event scene, and in any great 90s, mid 90s adult film. You want to finish with that. Mm-hmm. So the B team theme is more like the mid movie BJ montage, where it's like not even really set up. They just sort of cut away to it.
Yeah.
And it's like it kind of goes on for a long time. You know, it just allows you to charge your batteries, get a sandwich if you need it.
Features one of the main players, but he or she is with a different partner than they're going to be.
Exactly. Yep. People are trading off.
So the swinger theme just works.
Right. And it's not really a full-on orgy because, again, it's in the middle of the film, so they're not going to give away that much. It's just sort of, you know, to wet your whistle while you're, you know, in recovery, so to speak. And you'll probably end up fast-forwarding through it, but you'll watch it for a few minutes at least, just to, because you're kind of vibing to the music, and you're like, well, okay, this is working. All right, that's enough of that. Fast-forward, you know?
Yeah, you're in the middle of it, and all of a sudden you hear a New World Order.
Loser.
And you're like, I know I'm a loser. That's why I'm watching this film.
Takes you right out of
it. You have to tell me. Come on. Well, the other thing about Six is
Six entrance, to Midnight, if you will.
Ah! Yes. Not just
that gets you into it.
But there's anyway. there's also the fact that Six comes out with what I can only describe as 1996 Howard Stern hair.
Yep. Full bangs, full curls.
Curls, very poodle-like.
Yes, very in his face. And then he has the whole goatee.
The goatee, yep.
Look, he looks good. I mean, it's of the time. He doesn't look bad. He looks like a dick.
Every time I looked at hair in the match, I kept finding it distracting because I don't remember it ever looking like that. For some reason, I blanked that he ever looked like this in his life. And so I kept thinking about Jimmy Jam Garvin from the Freebirds.
That's a great comparison.
Holy shit.
He really does, though. Yeah. It's definitely just a very scumbaggy version of the clean cut 1-2-3 Kid, which, you know, it's kind of like, wow, I guess the kid grew up. He's, you know.
He skipped right to Six, motherfucker.
Yeah, it's went through adolescence. Now he's just this douchebag.
Which, I mean, you know, I'm into, if I'm being honest.
I get it.
He's real good at it, and Eddie's real good at being the baby face, of course, here. The crowd is sort of unsure.
Yes, I think that's the theme of the entire show with this crowd.
Yeah, they're like, what is this?
What did we buy tickets for?
And I'm with them at this point. Like, I'm still like, what? But also intrigued. And like you said, Eric is trying to sell the NWO as an upstart organization. So, you know, don't worry too much about the fact that Hall and Nash lost some belts or whatever. And, like, you know, it's fine. We're going to move on. We're going to move on to this. And then I didn't see the whole show, but I feel like the NWO doesn't really end up with a lot of these matches, or do they? Spoiler, but
I think they win them, except for I know the Outsiders lost and Eddie lost. Was that it? Outsiders and Six lost, I should say.
Yeah. Well, and they're going to sort. Eric Bischoff says they're basically going to sort that out administratively. So
okay.
We will get again throughout '97 and '98 the height of the NWO's powers, the administrative powers exploding week after week, with J.J. Dillon being extremely ineffectual and oftentimes getting kicked in the head by Eric Bischoff, figuratively and literally.
Isn't there a random match? Doesn't Chris Jericho lose to Masaccio on the undercard of this?
In the opener, yes. Yes, he does.
Weird.
I mean, there's a Big Bubba and Hugh Morris Mexican death match. which,
wait, what?
Why was it a Mexican death match?
I don't know. Maybe somebody was subbing for... So Conan hadn't joined the NWO yet. Maybe Hugh Morris is subbing for Conan, I want to say. I might have just made that up.
Makes some level of sense, more than Hugh Morris challenging someone to a Mexican death match.
I mean, yeah. You've got a Jeff Jarrett in VK Wall Street.
Good.
That sounds like death. Bagwell and Riggs, so the American male's exploding. Jenny, Bagwell was one of the WCW wrestlers who took Eric Bischoff up on his offer and said, yeah, I'll join the NWO.
Of course he was.
VK Wall Street was, and so was Big Bubba. So these are all, this is kind of a showcase for these new NWO recruits. You got Scott Norton, another one, going up against DDP, which I think is a no contest. I don't know. That's where they redo the angle where Paige pretends to join the NWO and then turns on them. It's like, I, for some reason, they wanted to do it again on pay-per-view, I guess.
Really protected Scott Norton, too, in those days.
And it protected Scott Norton. So there's that. Like you said, the Steiners and Outsiders thing, I'm pretty sure they put the titles right back on the Outsiders the next night because that's what they did.
Yep. And then not too long after that, where they shot that angle where the outsiders ran the Steiner brothers off the road and
they commit vehicular homicide.
Holy God! That sounds amazing.
All right. Honestly,
the match is whatever at this point, but I just wanted to know a lot about this whole fucking show. Anyway.
I feel like this is what we do on Talking WCW, though. We pick a wrestler, and then we just kind of use that as a springboard to talk about all the crazy shit that's going on in and around the matches that we Larry's actually choose.
Whatever it may be that comes to our mind at a given moment.
And that. So,
they suspend the belt above the ring, of course, and then you get, you know, like a lot of kicking and chopping to start with, and they fuck up a whip into a spinning backbreaker, but then they try again and get it the second time, so that works. I feel like they're both sort of, there's weird, like, it's not chemistry, it's not hate, it's like, okay, let's put something together.
Probably.
Just sort of a weird vibe on this one. But they're both really talented. Of course, Eddie is. And so Six goes to the outside. Eddie jumps off the top of the turnbuckle onto Six on the floor. It's like a bunch of aerial stuff, of course, from him. And he does a lot of these sort of balmy type moves throughout the match. Lots of flying. Is it a Bronco Buster that Six's move? Is that what it's called?
The one in the
guy's dick to the face.
Yeah, dick to the face. So I wrote that, and then I was like, I questioned myself. But that's what it is. Yeah. He hits that, and Eric talks about how Six is legit. You know, he's not one of these Hollywood guys like Jean-Claude Van Damme or Steven Seagal. I'm like, pretty sure it's the exact opposite, Eric Bischoff. But, okay.
Oh, no, he might be right when it comes to Steven Seagal.
Right about Seagal and wrong about Van Damme.
Okay.
Yes. Van Damme seems pretty, I mean.
I feel like it's pretty legit
Van Damme is legit, yeah. Van Damme, like, knocked dudes out before he was an actor.
You're not CGing those splits across the chair, you know, that RVD is going to later adopt.
Yes.
It's just real funny to me to just, like, lean into this entirely heel commentary that they've got going on, because anything good that Eddie does in this match is completely downplayed. So you're not ever going to get anybody talking about how great he is in this match, because that's the last, every time he does something great, they're talking about something else.
Yeah they know sell so it.
Let me tell you, tomorrow night I'm going to make sure to return the tag team titles right back to the Outsiders as Eddie Guerrero hits the power bomb here.
Yeah. drop kick Six out onto the floor, and then this motherfucker is talking about, which is great. I mean, as much as I hate Eric, like, this is fantastic for what he's doing overall. And it's very different for me, so I'm enjoying it. And then Six suplexes Eddie off the side of the apron onto the floor.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that. That was the of all the bumps in this match, that was by far the craziest. I thought
that was gross.
It was
something the way he landed. It was sick.
And okay, so you have to also include fucking Nick Patrick, because he is
your fave. Yes,
he is the ref in this, and he just looks exactly like Danny McBride. It's very off-putting. I swear to God, that's all I see when I see this guy. Anyway, and then after that Six suplex, he doesn't stop. He dives over the top rope onto Eddie again while he's still on the floor.
Camera almost missed.
Yes.
Came very close. That awesome, like, somersault senton, I guess you call it. I forget that Six used to do that move. He phases it out later on, probably just from injuries and wear and tear. But, 97, he would still bust out that and some other high spots.
Yeah, and he hit it real good. And then he climbs up the ramp, grabs a ladder, and then just smashes Eddie against the side of the ring with the ladder. So just like three, just like brutal spots in a row. And then they do the shaky cam footage there for a minute, which I guess is like part of that experimental production.
Oh yeah, the aerial thing, aerial view.
I couldn't tell what it was really.
That was, yeah. So
like
that
a guy
was,
with a camera on a stick, probably.
Uh-huh. They would do that. It was like the, I guess they just had a weird filter on the camera or something. Mm-hmm. It was like the NWO. It sort of made it look like they're, where they would do these,
it was a handy
kind of fake promotional spots. They would do mm-hmm. these commercials within the show.
Yeah, they make it look like they were filming it on a camcorder or something.
For NWO merchandise. I mean, it probably was on a camcorder. It just, you know, it was just that deliberate touch to differentiate it production wise from other things. I feel like it was also an early experiment in trying to do like an overhead, mm-hmm. Especially in this match where you would actually see from like a bird's eye view, which I don't think the WWF and their ladder matches had really tried yet, right? Those were still filmed pretty conventionally. I mean, they'd only done, what, the two at this point? But anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, three if you count the match that you're not supposed to acknowledge. The
one that we don't, yeah, the non-televised.
Yeah. but yeah, I don't know that they had done the overhead view yet. I'm not sure. For some reason, I remember the overhead view being, the first time I remember seeing that in the WWF was the Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian match from that one
paper. Mm-hmm. That's the one I'm thinking of, too, where they really pushed it. But I feel like WCW is sort of flirting in that direction here in this match. Mm-hmm. It was like they couldn't quite pull it off, but they were, I don't know, they're stabbing in that direction.
WCW would take chances on production stuff with a lot of,
mm-hmm.
remember the referee camera?
Oh God. Yeah.
So, you know, they would take chances on, sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't, but a lot of the stuff would later, you know, catch on, and I think that's one of them. They were definitely trying new things, especially around this time.
And around this time, you also get that big loser from. I don't know what that is, but I really like that.
It's amazing. I reference it. I joke about that with some of my friends to this day. That I'll just randomly drop a loser in the comments.
You should. Everybody should. It's amazing. So Eddie throws that ladder back in the ring, kind of gets it over the top rope and sort of seesaws it, like right into Six's face. A little bit of a fuck
spot.
You. Yeah, it's real good. after eating shit three times in a row, it's about time.
Yeah.
Eddie gets some good chops in the corner again. Six whips Eddie into the other corner into the ladder that he has set up. So they're doing a pretty good job incorporating the ladder. It's pretty, like, not a ton, but, you know, it's early in the match.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done some pretty good spots with it so far. Nothing crazy, but just, like, good build-up stuff. Six lays the ladder on top of Eddie and stomps on it twice, and that looks really good. He whips him and drops him into the ladder. Suplex, and then they both climb the ladder, even though it's not nowhere near under the belt. They forgot to move the ladder before they started climbing it. So then they have to disembark and try again, reset the ladder, which I'm just a mark for, like, resetting props in general. I don't know.
Like the furniture move.
I don't know why. It just is a thing. Six gets in the corner, kind of set up to ride the ladder, where he's going to, like, stand up on the ropes and then just sort of fall forward on it.
Uh-huh.
But Eddie kicks him and crotches Six right in the corner instead of that happening.
That was actually my favorite spot of the match because they set it up as like a callback to, again, the Sean Razor ladder matches. And DiBiase even says, oh, I've seen this before. I know what he's going to do. He's going to ride the ladder down onto Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're putting in your head. This is what's going to happen, but Eddie thwarts it. It's like
mm-hmm.
it is creating the impression that he has watched these matches, he's studied these matches, and learned from them. So he knows how to counter that, and he drop kicks the fucking ladder right into Six. As he said, Six crotches himself on that top rip. Just looks really brutal. And it's just a really cool counter that you wouldn't think of, especially in a 97 ladder match.
I would really hate for Six to like injure himself in any kind of turnbuckle situation, you know? For sure. Yeah, I hate that for him. Followed by a gigantic superplex by Eddie. They set up the ladder again and they climb to the top, and then Six does a, I think Eric calls a drop sidekick. Which looked really cool.
I wrote down inverted jump sidekick, which may not be right either.
Something like that.
That's like a tremendous Eric Bischoff call, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Like, he literally, like, lifts up from the top rung and drop kicks Eddie, and then they both fall down.
Fully, yep.
It's pretty awesome. Whatever you call it. Of course, Nick Patrick just continuing to help Six, like, set up the ladders and generally help him in any way he can, which is just so fucking weird. Like, I will just never understand, like, that. Because, like, what's the point if the ref's on your side? Like,
yeah, well,
it doesn't matter what
you do. It does kind of break, you know, when I was a youngling Anakin watching this match or watching this era of WCW, it didn't register with me as any. It was just, okay, he's a heel referee, he's a bad guy, you know, he's gonna cheat and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But then looking back on it as a grown person many years later, I'm like, why would he ever count a pinfall?
Yeah, that was my question. Like,
why would he,
especially at the finish of the fucking match? I'm like, what?
Keep him from climbing the ladder.
Yeah. So he's just real half-assed in everything he does, is my takeaway. And fuck Nick Patrick.
Maybe Nick Patrick. Was just afraid of being, he was terrified of being beaten up, so that's why he stayed out of most conflicts.
Well, I mean, that's fair, but also, sorry, you deserve a punch in the face. Anyway, they climb again to the top of the ladder, and they trade punches at the top. Eddie kind of jumps, is punched, lands on his feet, and then just fucking knocks the ladder over.
Yeah, on the rebound. Yep.
Yeah, so it's like so simple and so very effective. You know, it works. It's a great, like, break it up, like, fuck and you, and just knock the ladder over.
And actually, I believe, if I remember correctly, that's the finish of the first ladder match, the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels. He runs into it, knocks the ladder over, and Shawn crotches himself on the top rope and falls to the outside, whereas here, Six just kind of like stun guns himself on the top rope and falls into the ring.
So they climb again, and then they both touch the belt at the same time, and they sort of unhook it at the same time. They bring it down at the same time. Very fucking well done in time, because you could have fucked that up very easily.
Synchronization. And they would fuck it up many years later.
Yeah. So I was super, like, even though it was, like, kind of not what I want to see, like, I still appreciated, like, the timing of it. And Eddie just sort of smacks Six with the belt, and he falls. And then they call it for Eddie. And crowd goes crazy. Commentary is just aghast. Nick Patrick looks very not excited about holding his hand up, thinking, what could I have done to, like, not have this happen in this match, perhaps? But, and then the crowd, Eddie goes out in the crowd to celebrate. So just so different. Like, it's just an off-putting type match to me. And that was one of the reasons why I chose it. Like you said, we haven't seen any of the, like, heel Eddie stuff that I sort of know, not very well, but that I know. So seeing this side of him is, like, really cool for me, and I like this match a lot. I think Six is pretty fucking good in it.
I do too. Yeah, he's it's so weird. His run in WCW is really just the. I mean, he comes in '96, but he didn't. He wasn't really wrestling right away, was he, Greg?
I don't really remember, honestly. I don't think so. I think he was still injured, and then he starts wrestling in the late fall of '96.
He does get injured, like, towards the end of his run in '97. So, I mean, he's there for a year and some change, but he isn't wrestling for, like, all of it. it's almost forget he was there and kind of a big character in the NWO for that brief time when they, after that initial blow up that they had. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like I want to revisit some of his WCW stuff. Both from a character and just work standpoint. I know he had some, he had that program with Flair in kind of the spring, summer of 97, which, you know, leads to some unusual but entertaining matches. But yeah, I liked him here as well. It's been years since I've watched this match. I have almost completely forgotten about it. And it's so funny to watch just in the light of, like, ladder matches are a very overdone gimmick today. Mm-hmm. And going back to 96, this is, you know, maybe the third or fourth, depending on how you count them, on U.S. television, basically, and one of the big two promotions. People were not used to seeing these types of matches, and the guys were not used to working these types of matches. And I think that kind of comes across, Jenny, as you alluded to, with the two of them, Eddie and Six, kind of feeling each other out at first, going, all right, how do you want to do this? Because
pretty much
I've never worked a fucking ladder match. It's like, well, I haven't either. And they're sort of, I like the way they work up to bringing the ladder into the ring. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the model for these early ladder matches is you start off pretty conventionally and gradually escalate your spots and usage of the ladder. And you had more defensive spots with the ladder than offensive mm-hmm. spots, if that makes any sense, because the object is not to just do crazy, you know, aerial moves off the ladder because it's there, but to win the match, right? If you have to, you will resort to that, but it's not really supposed to be a showboaty type of match the way it's done today. But you still are going to have those spots because how can you not? It's a ladder match. So it's a really fine line. I feel like they walked, again, with these very early ladder matches. And, man, just seeing some of the bumps, especially involving the ladder, it almost takes you out of it in a way because you go, God, wrestling was just different in 1997 and they didn't do stuff like this in 1997. So to see a guy, you know, get crotched across the top rope after eating a ladder to the face, to just get whipped into a ladder, to, you know, get popped in the mouth mm-hmm. with a ladder. It's just
superplex on a ladder.
Superplex on a ladder. It's the type of stuff you see today, but you didn't see it all back then. So it's just extremely jarring. And you almost wonder, like, are they going, what the hell are we doing to ourselves? This is insane. And
but
it's
they just
so
keep doing it though, you know?
Yeah, it's so commonplace now. Yeah. It's going to, you know, I think they were pretty restrained at first. You see like a ladder match a year, maybe two. And now it's just, you know, it's easily four or five all the time. And on free TV, on pay-per-view, like just, I think it's gotten a little bit better than in the recent past, but there was a time where just remember, Greg, all those Money in the Bank matches, just they all got so interchangeable and,
there for a while, you were getting bank matches yeah. on pay-per-view, and then another one at WrestleMania sometimes.
Yeah. Yep.
And then, or there were even, I mean, honestly, that started the, what they call now the Ruthless Aggression era. There would be stretches where you'd see just on a random Raw ladder match, RVD
mm-hmm. versus Hardy, sure.
title.
Yep.
So, Jeff Hardy versus insert person here for insert title here. So yeah, it really got to a point where it was no longer special. Which I think was really bad because the matches are so hard on the guys' bodies.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. It just does them no favors to trot it out there so often. It just became exhausting to the viewers to say nothing for the guys in it who are killing themselves. You know, I've not heard a lot of like, I don't know, insider takes on this match. It seems to be a little bit overlooked and forgotten. I've never really heard Eddie talk about it, or, I mean, Sean Waltman for that matter. I'd be interested to know, like, what did they think? What are their takeaways from this thing? I mean, obviously we can't get that from Eddie now, but,
because he's daddy,
you know.
I think that it's on Eddie's DVD set that came out when he was still alive.
That's
I have done commentary over it, but I can't remember. It's been so long. I just walked into my room where all my wrestling DVDs are, and there's so much crap in front of my DVD shelf that I'm not even going to bother.
It's just tossed, yeah.
I can see that I can see the DVD, I can see where it is, but I can't get to it, so we'll have to look that up another time.
Fair enough.
Amazing.
In any case, it's a match that was really fun for me to revisit. I was glad you picked it, Jenny, and I don't know. I just wish I knew more about kind of the, you know, war stories around this one, because there's got to be some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this period of Sean. So, a couple of things. I hated Sean Waltman as a kid. I mean, hated it.
Really?
As a kid, as an adult, he was legitimately one of my least favorite wrestlers from the time he was the 1-2-3 kid. From when I was about 9 years old to about a year ago, Sean Waltman was one of my...
A year ago?
Jesus. In the business.
It took you a while to come around there, Greg.
I hated everything he did. I didn't like his matches. I didn't like his promos. I didn't like his character. I didn't like his mannerisms. This was the exception, though.
You didn't like the way he ate chicken.
I didn't like the general look of him.
His pranks.
Zodiac sign. That being said, the exception to that rule was when he was six. I loved six.
Okay.
Don't ask me why. I hated the ones who did. I hated X-Pac. Really bad. But I loved six. I thought six was cool. I thought six, he had a cool finishing move with the buzz killer, as he called it. Crossface chicken wing. I thought maybe because he was hanging out with really cool dudes, I thought he was cool by proxy, and I didn't.
Yes, that's it. Cool.
So I really liked Six. I thought he had some awesome matches with Rey Mysterio and Eddie here and some fun matches with Flair. I really got into Six. Only in the last year or so have I had the hindsight to look back and realize that Waltman was pretty damn good. And I begrudgingly admit to myself that, okay, I stand by some of the character things that I didn't like, but he was really good once the bell rang. Like, even here in this match, when the match starts and he hits that little martial arts combo on Eddie, that 35 times better than almost anybody that does those spots today. Like, it looked impactful. It looked real. It looked like he was actually hitting it. And it looked awesome. I'm like, good Lord, man, this dude was so much better than I gave him credit for as a kid. I don't know why I didn't like him as a kid, but I just didn't.
Sometimes you just got those guys that just rub you up.
Honestly, you'd think as a kid the 1-2-3 kid would have appealed to me, but I was just like, get this loser out of here. But anyway, he's great here. His offense is great. His selling is great. He does these cool high spots that were very innovative for the time. I just wanted to give him props because I'm coming around on realizing how ahead of his time Sean Waltman was. So just wanted to say that before getting to Eddie, who is obviously the premise of our episode. And Eddie is great here, as he always is. I thought both guys put their bodies through hell here. And yet there are a couple of moments of confusion, a couple moments where they may not have been on the exact same page. But I give them a lot of leeway because, as you pointed out, this is the third or fourth ladder match that anybody's ever seen, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the stuff that maybe today two great wrestlers could go in there and do, you know, like clockwork and not miss a beat. They didn't have that luxury. They didn't have all these years of other ideas and other things you can do. And as figuring it out matches go, is pretty darn good. They go through so many dangerous spots here. The suplex to the outside I mentioned earlier. The suplex off the ladder is a big bump. The crotch in the corner is a big bump that could have gone, you know, that's honestly, I think sometimes as fans, we lose sight of how some of these more simplistic bumps, quote unquote, can go wrong really easily. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Six knows.
Yeah, he knows. So, they both guys were great. And to your point also, Jenny, the crowd's a little dead at times during this match, but there are key moments when they get into it and they pop for Eddie and they're happy when Eddie wins, and which is kind of cool because again, even at this point, Eddie didn't have maybe you would disagree with this, Tim, but I feel like even at this point in early 97, Eddie still had not really found himself as a character yet. He was just over because he was a damn good wrestler.
Yeah, and I think that's true. At the same time, still over enough that they gave him the U.S. title.
Absolutely. He got over just through being really awesome, which you could do. It was easier to do that at that time because, you know, nowadays we're used to seeing these incredible athletes do all these things, and so it's almost like ho-hum if they don't have an interesting character. But back then, you didn't see guys doing what Eddie Guerrero could do, pretty much. So, yeah, he was awesome.
Right.
And then Six still doing that somersault dive, even after his injuries that he had suffered, even to that point, was incredible. So, yeah, I love this match, too. I thought it was terrific. A great launching pad, furthermore, for Eddie Guerrero, giving him a big win over...
It is a big win. I mean, this is a big, clean win over a major NWO guy, which was rare at any point during the peak of their powers, in a really high-profile kind of special event kind of match. I mean, to give Eddie the win here and you know, there's no screwy, like, they're going to overturn it or anything. Like, they can't get out of this one. That's the great thing about a ladder match. It really leaves no ambiguity, right? Regardless of whether the referee is in the bag for the other guy or not, you retrieve the title, that's it. You won. That's why this finish is also impressive to me. Like you said, just the fact that they could have fucked it up and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And realistically, I don't think we see a finish like this in a ladder match until Sean and Jericho?
Sean and Jericho at No Mercy.
Yeah, then that's more than, God, that's 11 years later. That's the only time they've done a finish in a ladder match similar to this, where both guys have hands on the belt, actually pull it down from the strap, and it's like a tug of war type situation. Mm-hmm. They never did that other than this, and to my knowledge, that match between HBK and Jericho, many years later. So it's an innovative finish, and it would remain so for quite some time.
Yeah, I thought it was super unique. Another thing I wanted to mention, and part of the reason why I chose this, is because Sean Waltman ended up showing up on that GCW show that I watched recently. And so
the past pay-per-view they had.
So it looks like he's maybe returning to do some stuff, which is interesting, I think. And
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious to see what else he's got. You know?
Yeah, no, I'm happy for him. Like I said, part of it is kind of like Sean Waltman's, part of me coming around on him has been his sort of outside the ring transformation in the last 10 years or so, because for a long time, he was kind of a train wreck, of a person but seeing him get it all together and kind of reflect back on his career so clear headedly and things like that has made me appreciate what he did more. And so I'm all for him coming back. I hope he has a nice little run, interesting matches with some of the guys that were inspired by his early work.
And he's still so young, and he's in great shape, and he's still fucking alive, you know, so that's pretty amazing.
That kind of counts for a lot. With,
in general, yes.
Yeah, his just being a wrestler and being hot during this time period, mm-hmm. And the party he the company he kept, just, yeah, I would love to see him have a comeback. That would be a true feel-good story in wrestling that I think we sort of need right now. So I'm all for it. I'd love to see that.
All right. I think that brings us to our third match. Greg, what did you choose for us?
Well, Tim talked about how he likes finding the hidden gems and talking about them on our show.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. I decided to go in the exact opposite direction. I find the most obvious choice that one could possibly make, and I make that choice. Or at least in this case, I did that because I went with the most famous Eddie Guerrero WCW match, the greatest WCW cruiserweight match. I went with what I would posit to be the greatest match in WCW's entire company history. I went with Eddie Guerrero from Halloween Havoc. I should specify Halloween Havoc 1997, Las Vegas, Nevada. Eddie Guerrero defending the cruiserweight championship in a mask versus title match. Against, at that time, his new rival, who would become his longtime rival and occasional partner, Rey Mysterio Jr. This is, I mean, honestly, if you haven't seen this match, I'd be very surprised if you're listening to our show and haven't seen this match.
Right. This is what we call
the crowd. I'm doing the show, and I just saw this match. So.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. I legitimately thought you had already seen this match before. If you haven't seen this, folks, the listeners, nothing that I say is going to adequately describe how great this match is. Go watch it. It is, it's a masterpiece. It is perfection. I think that this, a lot of the modern wrestlers have been chasing this match for 25 years, and nobody, in my opinion, at least in our country, a lot of great matches. Not knocking them at all, but this is style of wrestling done to perfection. Eddie Guerrero had recently turned heel and was getting into one of my favorite runs of his career, which was this sleazy, grimy heel character that he starts playing in the late summer of 97. I mean, even his entrance, just how the look of disdain that he has for everyone around him, he just looks like he's miserable, like he's angry at the world.
Just a carries bastard.
The title slung around his back, which I admit, little things matter in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Really matter, and I had never seen anybody carry the title the way that he carried it, and it made him stand out among
other things. Amazing.
He got himself in the best shape of his life to that point. He had a complete transformation from the kind of, you know, he wasn't, at no point was he out of shape, but he looked a little pudgy, you know, when Nitro first started. And he
I think that jumpsuit did him no favors.
I agree.
Yeah.
He's got an incredible ring attire here. Some of the best ring attire in the business at the time. He's in incredible shape. Like, Eddie Guerrero at this point in 1997, there's a line in commentary during this match where Bobby Heenan says, this guy might be the most talented man right now in all of wrestling, and I'm talking about Guerrero. And he ain't lying.
Mm-mm.
Dusty would say the same thing on Saturday night for an Eddie match during this era. He was hitting his stride as a character. His promos were very good. The crowds hated him. Eddie sucks chants all over the place. Eddie Guerrero was the man at this point. And then we have his opponent, Rey Mysterio Jr., who comes out with the movie tie-in, his first movie tie-in costume that I'm aware of, which was tie-in to the previous year's, I think it was the previous year's, Billy Zane. Movie The Phantom.
The Phantom. Slam Evil, Greg.
You have to slam evil. You have no choice but to slam evil.
I'm sorry. He's doing the Phantom cosplay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did not catch that in any way whatsoever. So
it's weird because I guess this is just where superhero films were in 1997. Rey Mysterio, you have to figure, not a big fan of Spawn. From that summer.
See, Spawn was the first thing I thought of, but.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't translate to the most obvious cosplay. Steel, that's not going to work either.
No.
But I mean, you got Batman and Robin, but again, do we want to remind people of that just a few months after it left theaters?
I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't. It's an awesome
movie. It would you know, take a few years for people to come around.
Yeah, at that
if they do on that.
With folks. But he was left with the Phantom. He could have done the Shadow, the Alec Baldwin.
Oh, take it really further back, yeah.
But he goes with the Phantom, and it's one of his most famous costumes. The bodysuit connected to the mask, which was an interesting...
super cool, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So Rey Mysterio Jr., I should also lay the stage for what he was doing at this point. He was wrestling Eddie Guerrero for the Cruiserweight title. He was already well known at this point as WCW's top cruiserweight. He had pretty much had that division not on lockdown in terms of being a champion all the time, but he was the guy, at least in my mind, as a 13 at this time. In my mind, yeah. He, like, when somebody said cruiserweight, he's the guy I thought of. He was doing innovative things nobody'd ever done before. What made him stand out from the other luchadors was he hit 99.9% of his moves. Like, there wasn't the usual, like, well, you can't really tell if Super Kolo is going to actually land on his opponent or not. Rey was...
Who are you to doubt Super Kolo?
Rey was precision. He was precision. He was energy. He had charisma, even though he wasn't a promo per se. He had charisma. He connected with fans because he knew when to time his comebacks. He was the best athlete in wrestling. Let's be honest.
He was the star of the cruiserweight division of, if you can call it, the luchadors.
Absolutely, the best athlete in wrestling at that time, and you're not at this point. He's the ultimate babyface. Everybody loves Rey Jr. because they know they're going to get something cool out of him, and everybody hates Eddie because Eddie's just a scumbag. He's tapped into this part of himself that American fans had not seen yet, which brings me to the other key part of this match that helps cement its legacy, the commentary. Mm-hmm. You have Tony Schiavone, Bobby the Brain Heenan, the American Dream Dusty Rhodes, as only he can do, and importantly, the Professor, Iron Mike Tenay.
Of course. You cannot have a lucha match in any way without Mike Tenay.
No, right? No. You can't. Mike Tenay has to give us the background of Rey Mysterio as El Calibri, the hummingbird. all kidding aside.
And the fucking Guerrero family tree at that.
Yes, the Guerrero family tree, and getting into Eddie's history prior to WCW and talking about where Tony and Dusty are just shocked by Eddie's behavior lately, and him lending that sort of idea that, well, you guys didn't know him before WCW. I knew him before WCW, and I saw him stab partners in the back, and this is the real Guerrero. Loved that part of the match, of this masterpiece. I mean, I'm not...
And I'm sorry to interrupt while you're on a roll here, but I just want to say that is something that I loved about WCW, just the fact that they would... acknowledge that their wrestlers had lives and had careers outside of and prior to WCW.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I don't know, it gave them more of a, it just made them the world of WCW feel more full. Like, these guys actually have interior lives that is not just, doesn't just revolve around, well, there's WWF and nothing else, right? Like, anything.
It gave the company credibility, and it helped. And as a kid that I knew most, I kind of knew how wrestling worked by that point. I knew it wasn't all legitimate and all that. However, WCW made it easier to suspend your disbelief because like that, little touches like that. WWF, you just kind of had to watch it as a show.
It was its own little realm of the wrestling world. And I understand why they do that. It's kind of a, you know, it's we're the be all end all. So why are we talking about what you've done in some other rinky dink company? Right? I mean, I get that, but at the same time, it's like it's like a very insecure sort of thing to do. At the same time, I feel like to just act like they're not only the only game in town, but the only game in town that matters. And it's just
right.
it just adds to that feeling of artificiality that I think is so much more pronounced these days when it's just WWE Universe this and WWE Universe that. I just get so sick of their invented augmented reality that bears no resemblance to any world that anyone has ever occupied.
I always think back to the episode of Superstars where the character of Saba Simba debuted, and and Roddy Piper's on commentary, and he goes, "That ain't no Saba Simba, that's Tony Atlas."
Kayfabe pipes.
But yeah, I all of these ingredients that we're talking about add up to sort of the perfect storm. You have a wrestler in Eddie Guerrero who is at the best form of his career. This, in my opinion, 1997 Eddie Guerrero is the best Eddie Guerrero. He is the best wrestler in the world. I shouldn't say the world. I know we'll have a lot of people. What about Misawa and all this stuff? I don't know. I wasn't watching them, but I was watching all the American wrestling that I could get, and nobody in American wrestling at that point was better than Eddie Guerrero. And then you've got Rey Mysterio Jr., who was the most innovative wrestler in the world, the guy that was defining what would become the predominant style of wrestling. I mean, let's face it, Rey was, 30 years ahead of his time, pretty much.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, he does things in this match that not only was nobody doing at the time, but guys today can't do.
No.
They will try and botch it. You know,
when I said that wrestlers have been chasing this match for 25 years, that's what I mean. Guys have tried to, the only guy I've seen recreate some of the spots in this match was Ricochet, but the actual matches, I've not seen one that's pulled it off to this degree, this flawlessly, and felt this real and felt this, you know. Sometimes it can come across, you might get, on a rare occasion, you might get a perfectly executed athletic match, but it doesn't feel real. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel
right.
Organic. You might get a match that feels real and organic, but they can't pull off what some of the things that Ray pulls off in this match. I mean, the somersault Hurricanrana to the outside.
Yes.
It shouldn't be possible.
Eddie Guerrero deserves a shit ton of credit for that. Ray deserves a shit ton of credit for that. And I talk about the little things in wrestling mattering. When Rey Mysterio does a Hurricanrana, he locks his legs around the opponent's head and makes it look like he's actually sending the guy over. He doesn't just lay his legs on top of them and the guy takes a front bump. Mm-hmm. The spot that I think most, even Rey has said that he chased this spot for many years and could never recreate it. The backflip DDT off the rope.
Oh, God.
Yes.
One of the best.
That's the spot that I always point to. He just kind of so casually rattles it off. Like it's just any old transitional move. And it's like no one has ever pulled that off so gracefully since.
Now that's one that I do remember vividly watching on either the Eddie DVD or the first WWE Ray DVD. He did commentary on the match on the DVD, I think with Eddie, and he talks about he said that's the one. He said that's the moment. I've tried to recreate that move. We've tried to recreate that move in matches each other. We've never been able to pull it off like that.
Yep.
That's amazing to me.
Even the two guys who basically invented it can't do it again.
Can't do it again. It's one of those. When I say a perfect storm of ingredients for a match. Commentary. So many times, WCW commentators, and I think I talked about this on our last show, that I feel like the WCW commentary team at times got a bad rap by the dirt sheets and whatnot at the time. But I think that it is a fair criticism, and we talked about it a little bit with the Flair match. Sometimes WCW commentary, it does get stuck talking about things that are important to the match.
Right.
But not the case here. Mm-mm. The commentators, and maybe because I like to think that it's because all of the guys at that table recognized what they were seeing a few minutes into the match. Like, because they don't go off on tangents about Piper and Hogan and Bischoff. They are locked into this thing. They're talking about how great an athlete Eddie Guerrero is. They're talking about the heart of Rey Mysterio. Bobby is unusually focused in this match.
Yes.
That's like rambling.
For a cruiserweight match with two dudes who are not like Bobby Heenan guys, because you know, like, who's a Bobby Heenan guy and who isn't, regardless of match quality, you can tell when he's into a match and when he's not. And yep. This is holding his attention.
He's into this. He's getting into the psychology of the match, the strategy. They're all kind of drawn in by Eddie's character. There's no dead time. Even the match, even when they slow down in this match, and there are times when they have to because they're working at such a pace, Eddie puts him in a hold and works it. Mm-hmm. And if he's got an abdominal stretch, he doesn't just sit in the abdominal stretch. He rips at the mask. And he's almost mm-hmm. like he's trying to rip Ray's entire face off of it, his identity off of him. Ray is just fighting from underneath. He's reaching out, doing that Ricky Morton sell of reaching out to the crowd, you know, begging for help and somehow staying alive the entire match. Eddie dominates a lot of the offense in this thing. He controls it with his power, the tilt-a-whirl backbreaker and countering Ray's finishing move, the springboard Hurricane Rana into the backbreaker.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, Eddie spikes him with maybe the best power bomb I've ever seen.
Holy shit! Yes,
perfect. Yeah. Holds him up on himself.
Oh God!
They're convinced that it's over. Everybody thinks it's over. A great near fall there. Eddie is just almost like Eddie is looking down on Ray the entire time. Like Ray is beneath him, and he's here to just not just beat him, but he's going to hurt him. And he tries to with backbreaker after backbreaker. Power bombs, you know. I like that. Maybe a young Roderick Strong watched this match.
Yeah, really. Master of the backbreaker.
And but then Eddie would give when it was time for a hope spot or a comeback. Eddie knew exactly what to do, and Ray knew what to do. One of the best spots in the match. There's so many. It's hard for me to even pick out the best spots in the match. But he's tied up in the tree of woe, and Eddie gets that devilish look on his face, like he's a baseball slide drop kick. And Ray sits up, and Eddie slides at 100 miles an hour, crotch first into the pole. And then right out of that, Eddie's grabbing his swollen balls as he backs up to the railing, and then Ray flies off the top rope over the post, which was elevated above the turnbuckle, with a cross body block. I mean, this match, and another testament to his greatness, how many times have we talked about cruiserweight matches at that time, even in the sixth match a minute ago, in front of dead crowds, in front of audiences that are sitting mm-hmm. with hands while these dudes are mm-hmm. killing themselves in front of them. This crowd is into this match the whole time. They want Rey Mysterio to win. They hate Eddie. They're also blown away by the moves that Rey is doing. The somersault Hurricane Rana is just blows them away, and the announcers, I think, you know, Tony Schiavone, when it's all said and done, says this will go down as one of the greatest title matches we've ever seen in our sport. For once, not an exaggeration. The back and forth, Ray coming back down the stretch and Eddie cutting him off every time, it's great. Ray, at one point in the corner, Eddie is teeing off on Ray in the corner. And Ray actually starts fighting back and slugging back with forearms. And that's not something Ray was known for. He wasn't known for his striking. He wasn't known for punching exchanges. And that's one of the first times we ever really got to see Ray fire up like that and show that, yeah, he can brawl a little bit too. And just the picture perfect execution. They go to the top rope. Eddie's going to try to give him a back suplex off the top rope. Ray fights him off. Eddie elbows him in the ribs, doubles him over, and gets behind him and is trying to give, known as Splash Mountain in Mexico. It was the razor's edge, essentially, off the middle rope.
Uh-huh.
Hoists him up to do it. Ray does the exact same counter that he got psychosis with about a year earlier. It's the reverses it into the Hurricane Rana, grabs the legs, 1, 2, 3.
Crowd terrifying, goes. Terrifying spot.
Oh, boy.
I always think, okay, somebody's going to break their goddamn neck.
Yeah. There's
just no way. That
so much in this match had a minuscule margin of error. Like such a small margin of error. And again, you must keep in mind for anybody that would say, well, I've seen Will Ospreay or the Young Bucks do this.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see it in 1997. and you didn't see it, and nobody else had ever done it before, and nobody knew exactly how to take it. So these are two guys doing things for the very first time on the biggest stage of all, and in front of a nationwide pay-per-view audience, thousands of people in the arena, and they've got these people in the palm of their hands. Safe to say, I don't think that anybody in the company looked at the rundown that day. Maybe they thought that Eddie and Ray might steal the show, but there's no way they thought these guys are going to go out and put on a match that will – I'll compare it to Savage and Steamboat. I think this was WCW's Savage and Steamboat. This is a match that is short, relatively. What are we looking at, about 15 minutes, give or take?
Yeah, well, and it's not even you would think of this as like, oh, this would be a good hot opener for the pay-per-view, and it's not even. It's the second match, which in a lot of ways – a little bit of a death slot. The saying from Chris Jericho? You either wanted to be opening or closing the show, basically.
Yeah, for sure.
And you damn sure didn't want to be second, because that's just like, you know, nothing happening. But here they are with the second match on the card, holding the crowd's attention and blowing everything else away on this, which is a pretty solid pay-per-view all told, but this is the match that just takes it to just the next level. I mean, it turns it into a breakout show.
This was two guys that were not going to be denied. They went out there with the intention of stealing the show. They were not going to be denied. They were both trying to make a statement, I think, in their careers that they deserved maybe a higher spot than they were getting. And I mean, it's the template. It's a match that people study today. Wrestlers, some of the great wrestlers that we know of, that we see every week on TV, study this match to this day. It inspired wrestlers, you know, from people from Sasha Banks on down. It inspired a lot of modern day great wrestlers seeing the execution in this match. And I can't say enough about it. Genuinely, if anybody watched as a match, not just from this show, any of our shows, I would say watch this. I don't mean to be controversial in saying that it's my favorite WCW match. I love the Flair Steamboat matches. I love all of that stuff. It's amazing. But if I had to pick one match to sit down and watch from WCW, it would be this one, because every time I watch it, it's new to me. Even though, at this point, hundreds of times probably, it's just such a work of art. It's amazing.
I love that you put over the precision of the match, because that's what I kept thinking about too. It's like, how are they doing it like so fucking perfectly? Very little mistake. Like, there's very little bullshit. It's all fucking good. Just straight up good to amazing. And the whole vibe of Eddie as a character, like, our previous match, you know, he was, you know, babyface guy, you know, like, that was in January. And at this point, everybody fucking hates him. And you know it, like, automatically. Like, there's never even a question. Like, he is just hated so much. But his work in this match, and with Ray, the chemistry is off the charts. Like, and all the callbacks. I enjoy, like, as much as I hate saying it, I like me some Mike Tenay when he can stay focused and use his knowledge to the best degree, which he does here. Inserting it where it's needed and then laying out when you don't need to fucking talk anymore, Mike Tenay. So I would agree with you about the commentary, probably taking this to the next level as well. Because if we don't know this stuff about Eddie, I feel like a lot of this is like, what? You know, like, when he does, like, a callback to, like, Gory Special, like, his dad's move, like, in the match. And then they tell us about that. So, for me, that was, like, pretty helpful, I felt like.
And there's a great, we also get the great line on commentary of when Ray does that amazing move right before it happens, Dusty's talking about athleticism.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of athleticism. Athleticism, Dusty? Yeah, that's right. And just move and they
so, look, Dusty can say it however he wants to.
Absolutely.
I really love the crotching himself on the post move, because it's so simple. Like, all Ray had to do was just, like, lift his body up to avoid it. Like, a dodge. Like, very simple movement with maximum effect. Which he does, like you said, perfectly in the way that he grabs people with his legs around the neck. And you don't see the guy flipping. You see Ray grabbing that guy and flipping him, which is very subtle, like you said, but also something that I did notice and is pretty specific to Ray, if I'm being honest, a lot of times. So, I mean, tremendous, like, battle. I'm glad somebody picked this. It came up, of course, when I was asking for matches to do, and I'm really glad that somebody picked it, so I got to watch it finally. And that power bomb was next level,
to the point where it's like you watch it and you're like, how did he not get concussed?
Yes, and to the point where I tweeted it, because I was like, this is cool and everybody needs to see it. It's very, very good. The way he folded him up for the near fall was what did it. You know, that little extra that Eddie did. Yeah. Awesome, awesome. And I love that way that Ray wins this match. I've not expected that at all. So, and he did it real clean, too. So, fucking awesome, tremendous, amazing match. Probably, I mean, we did see my favorite match of all time on this show, but this might be a little bit better.
Well, you think so?
Yeah, certainly, at least in the same.
Talk about controversy.
Right?
I'll just say I'm glad that this match got the second chance, basically, because we did a Rey Mysterio episode, and talk about controversy. Controversially, we did not have this match on that episode of Talking WCW. I feel like we still talked about it just to say why it didn't make the list, but we sort of had to acknowledge how important it was. So to be able to talk about it proper has been great. Greg, you sort of mentioned that it seemed like these guys went out there with a real sense of purpose, maybe with a chip on their shoulder even, to really steal the show. I think that might be backed up by a little bit of word on the street, Greg, Jenny, and the bullshit politics in the back have it that Ray was actually asked or demanded by Eric Bischoff to lose this match and thereby lose his mask here on pay-per-view. And Ray really pushed back on that, was like, you know, you got to understand the importance of this to my career and to my culture, and like how where I am in my career right now. That's a real game changer, and it's not something I'm willing to do right now. And I think he eventually made a compromise with Bischoff where he said, look, you know, I will lose the mask in WCW, but I'm not going to do it, you know, in 1997. In this match on this pay-per-view. It's just, I'm, you know, let's save that one for a little bit down the road.
So and he really had to bring it, is what you mean. Like, he had to do something to for that.
I think so. Yeah. I think he felt like, you know, I pushed back so much. I've got to really go out there and prove myself so that, you know, my boss doesn't think I'm just some scrub who's hard to deal with, you know, which I can't imagine anyone would think of 1997 Rey Mysterio. But you got to figure, this is a guy in his early 20s at the time. He's like, what, 22 maybe? And having to sort of go to bat and advocate for himself against not just, you know, a booker, not just, you know, the booking committee, but this is an executive. Like, this is coming from Eric Bischoff directly, who is everybody's boss. So, I mean, I just think that kind of speaks highly to him, just in the way that a lot of guys are almost willing to go with the flow now. And I'm not trying to do a whole, well, you know, these millennials won't reach for the brass ring, like the old man Boomer McMahon speech that he gave about, which is such nonsense. But, I mean, at this time period, that's just, crazy that a guy in Ray's position would do that. Would just, and it's not even so much going into business for itself as it is just taking up for himself, knowing his value, knowing what he's worth, and pushing for it. It's not like he had creative control in his contract or anything. No, Bischoff could have told him to go piss up a rope. You know, tough shit. You're going to lose your mask. But
it wasn't about him not wanting to put Eddie over. Certainly, it was
no
about the mask element.
Mm-hmm. So and I think the way that the match has worked, it tells a great story, right? Because there are all these moments that we've called out, these moves, if you will, but it's got such a solid foundation of Eddie working over the back. He keeps going to these very grounded, like abdominal stretch and backbreaker kind of basic moves that are designed to ground Ray, to basically get him off of his aerial game. And Greg, as you pointed out, the way that Eddie works the mask, even as if it's a limb, you know, just tearing into it, like it's, that's part of the psychology of the match in a lot of ways. I mean, it speaks directly to the stipulation and Ray's, fear that he's going to lose this and lose his mask and lose his legacy and everything. It's also kind of ingenious that moment when Eddie actually does tear open the mask, and we get kind of a glimpse. Mm-hmm. We don't see his whole face, of course, but we see enough of Rey Mysterio to actually see him emoting, which you've never seen, because you've never had this stipulation. You've never seen him so exposed as he is here. So that just adds so much to the story and to the psychology of the match. But again, it just felt like, in a lot of ways, there's something supernatural about, I mean, it's Halloween Havoc, so I guess that's appropriate. But the way that it's really four spots in particular that had all the reason in the world to go sideways and just come off beautifully. We talked about that springboard backflip into a DDT, fluid as it can be. The somersault into the Hurricane Rana on the outside, breathtaking. The finish, of course, Splash Mountain, which, again, I always fear for their lives doing that. But I'll tell you a subtle one that we haven't mentioned, that I just popped for so big. It's early in the match when Ray goes for, it's kind of like that,
handspring. You know,
that handspring back elbow that Muda does. And as he's kind of just rotating after the cartwheel, he floats right into it. Eddie catches him, boom, right down into a back suplex in one smooth motion. It's just, it's like a dance. It's like watching two dance, incredibly skilled dancers or ice skaters almost. I don't know how else to describe how elegant
it is
for such a violent spectacle.
If pro wrestling were in the Olympics, it would get perfect tens. Like the execution, degree of difficulty, everything.
Work of art. That's what this match is. No other way to put it. That's wrestling as art, really.
Well, I guess the only thing left to do, maybe, do we want to talk about honorable mentions? I mean, there's probably a lot. I know there was. For me, I got, I just had the list, and then it went away. I think Dean Malenko at Uncensored 97.
That match suffers for a bad cutaway in the middle of it to a bunch of NWO bullshit backstage, and it's not their fault. It really hurts the flow of the match. And it's a decent match, but I'm glad we didn't pick it, just because I think it does a disservice to both guys, really. But
I got Jericho at Fall Brawl 97, and then Kidman at Starrcade 98.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I forget about that Kidman match. Yep.
There's a triple threat match with Eddie, Juventud and Ray, I believe. No, or am I getting this confused? There was a triple threat cruiserweight match at either World War, I think it was World War III, 98. And I want to say that Eddie was involved. Anyway, I could be way off base. I really should have researched that before talking about it on the show. But nonetheless, I thought about that match that we talked about with Benoit, their first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had that too.
The first Eddie Guerrero Dean Malenko match on Nitro was also on my, because that was equally as mind blowing. And that was the first time I'd seen that, what is now almost routine in a match, that pinfall sequence that they made famous. So I had that on as an honorable mention. There was a tag match from Thunder in 98, which was Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho teaming together. And for the life of me, I think their opponents were Benoit and Malenko.
Oh Lord.
They did that match a lot. That was a combination they would throw out there, with no real feud or anything, just when they needed a time filler. Yeah.
And this was 98, and it was a great match. I say I haven't seen it since it aired live, but I remember it. I've never forgotten how great that match was. Just as a throwaway match on Thunder with superior workers, tremendous stuff.
So I had most of those mentioned, like the first Benoit match on Nitro. Eddie and Dean at Starrcade, which I rewatched it and it was like, not really as good as I remembered. I think it's because it just pales in comparison to like their classic ECW stuff, which, I mean, it's really on the heels of that Eddie came into the company. Well, Eddie and Dean both, I guess, really, came into WCW. But God, if people haven't seen those, I know this is the WCW show, but by all means, get on the network and find the Malenko Guerrero classic, a trilogy of just all time matches that they had in ECW.
Great is when they came to Nitro, they would do that. They would wrestle each other, but they had such a more condensed time frame. So they pretty much work those same matches, but condensed them into 6-minute matches. It was like nothing you'd ever seen before on American Thumb. Incredible worker.
I had some Ultimo. I mean, Ultimo Dragon and Eddie did quite a bit of work together throughout like the fall of '97.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any one in particular really stood out to me. They also have a pay-per-view match at Slamboree 98. That was sort of in the middle of the whole Eddie brainwashing Chavo stuff.
Eddie Guerrero is my favorite wrestler.
Which is insane. I know, I can't believe we don't have anything from that deep character building year that was 98 for both of them. But yeah, I think it's telling that all of our choices are from like 96, 97 when, you know, he has two more years with the company, but, 98, I don't think is a great, it's not bad, but it's just not the best in terms of standout matches for Eddie. 99, probably less so, just, you know, he comes back kind of halfway through the year from,
pretty bad,
terrible car crash. Yeah. And looked, I mean, probably the best he's ever looked in his life, but, you know, wasn't given the best opponents or much of a showcase, I feel like, through, I mean, really the end of his run, which there's not much more of it after that. So
the biggest almost honorable mention for me, which I just remembered existed, would have to be the Starrcade 95 match. Juro Itani, versus WCW.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a great match. It really is. Like, it's another one of those cold matches where nobody in that crowd knew who Shinjiro Itani was, but they love the match. So, check that one out too, folks, if you haven't.
All right. So, whose turn is it?
I believe it's my turn. If I'm not mistaken.
Okay. All right.
And I thought that it would be good for us to We've spent our last few episodes talking a lot about the Nitro era of WCW, so I want to take it back old school a little bit. Oh, for my selection for next month's episode, I have selected Jim Cornette's Midnight Express.
Holy shit. Bless you. All right, now, bless you, Gregory.
To be clear, can we do any version of the Midnight Express?
I'm good with it. I don't remember what the ground rules were for the show that we set up when we started it, but
it's whatever you want, baby.
Yeah, we've done Crockett era stuff before. So yeah, if you want to do Condry and Eaton, if you want to do Lane and Eaton.
I mean, I'm gonna do Lane and Eaton. I'm just
Either way, I'm good with any of it. I'm always up for watching Midnight Express matches I haven't seen before. So.
Oh man, I'll tell you what.
I'm excited about this.
I could not be more thrilled because I had a blast watching just tons of Midnight Express matches throughout the 80s, obviously. For the greatest WCW match and wrestler back-to-back projects for Place to Be Nation, those two stretch projects that we did. And it just exposed me to tons of classic, incredible matches that I had never seen. Some that I felt like didn't live up to the reputation, others that, if anything, over-delivered. So, I've got quite the laundry list that I could choose from that effort. I've got a spreadsheet of star ratings, baby. I'm just gonna delve into it.
There we go. No, that's awesome. See that, and that's great because I'm going mainly off of my childhood memories of the Midnight Express because I can start remembering really well around like the end of 88 and 89, but I don't remember their stuff before that. But you know, I've watched in hindsight, obviously the scaffold matches they had. The big one, of course, against the Road Warriors. But I have, and I've seen, you know, of course, we talked about the Great American Bash match against the Southern Boys. And I've seen some of the Rock and Roll Express matches from their heyday. But I haven't seen, you know, as much of the Midnight. I mean, I've seen enough of the Midnights. They're one of my favorite teams of the era. But I haven't seen enough of the Midnights. I haven't. Mm. You know, some of the classics against the Fantastics.
That's what I'm talking about. 100%. I'm going to pick a Fantastics match.
I love that you and me both popped for that.
Yeah, I've seen maybe one of the Fantastics match, which was appropriately enough.
That's all it takes.
But yeah, so I'm looking forward to this project because outside of pay-per-view, I haven't seen a lot of their best stuff. So looking forward to this. And the stuff that I have seen, I love. So. You know, there's just so much to choose from with either combination of the Midnight Express. So I feel like it's one that will give us a good variety. And also, tag team wrestling is always going to be my favorite. So anytime we have a chance to talk about that, I'm going to be pushing for it.
Awesome. So stay tuned for that. Quote unquote next month, also known as
next episode,
probably
next episode.
In
How
3 months.
No, it won't be that
next episode. That's a good way to say it. Until then, Tim, do you have any podcast projects that you would like to promote?
I would just like folks to make sure they subscribe today to this podcast network, which is Place to Be Nation Wrestling. If you're enjoying this podcast, look, we've got a bevy of fantastic wrestling podcasts over here. So if you're not subscribed, why aren't you? Subscribe now. Get in on all the action. This, of course, has a sister network that is known as Place to Be Nation Pop, the Place to Be Nation Pop Experience, as we call it. I am part of a panel that does a show called Pop Goes to the Couch, where we are covering the Disney Plus. We're pulling double duty, in fact, on Pop Goes to the Couch right now. We're covering the Disney Plus series, The Book of Boba Fett. I almost called it something else.
The Book of Mormon?
The Book of Mandalorian?
I don't want to get into spoilers is the problem. But suffice to say, the show is not exactly the show that it's billed as in recent episodes. But anyway, all that is to say, check that out. We're covering that kind of the first half of the week, the beginning of the week, and then midweek you'll find reviews of Peacemaker, the great John Cena vehicle from HBO Max, which has been uniformly praised by pretty much all of us on that panel.
As it should
so,
be.
Yeah.
What a delightful surprise.
Oh, my Jesus, yes.
If you told me I would be enjoying a John Cena superhero show more than a prestige Disney Plus Star Wars limited series, I would have slapped you and your mom in the face. Like, I just can't believe that this is the world we live in. But
which might be an overreaction, but
sure.
No, it's not.
But granted, talk about something over delivering. Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Fucking Cena's a national treasure. I'm sorry, he just is.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting it. Even though he has Batista veins now.
I don't give a fuck.
He does look like an old road map, but that's
horrible.
I thought you were going to comment on the fact that his face looks more like Jim Varney as he is.
Well,
he is turning into Ernest as well, but I love this Cena, and I will not allow anyone to ever take him from me. You know, we also have, it's really the quad of pods, as we call it, so check out the North-South Connection if you're jonesing for even more wrestling content, a little more eclectic mix of wrestling content over there, some analytical shows, really just a really original approach to wrestling podcasting, things that you you don't typically find covered in your run-of-the-mill wrestling podcasts over on North-South. So that's a kind of different flavor of wrestling and pop culture as well. I co-host a show over there called 9021 No-So with JT Rosero and a rotating guest each month. We're just chronologically covering the original Beverly Hills 90210 from the start. Just going episode by episode, and we're more than halfway through the first season now. If you like that show or you'd like to join us as a guest on that podcast, reach out to me or JT. We'll get you in there because we're going to need guests for as many episodes as this show has. But that's a real joy to do. I'd like you as well to support placetobenation.com, the website where we are unveiling slowly the results of the greatest WCW wrestler project. So all throughout the year of 2021, we made our list. We tallied our votes. You guys will be pleased that I submitted the ballot on behalf of Talking WCW. So as we
finished it.
Oh yes, I got that in some time ago. But you know, as we so painstakingly scrutinized the three of us and went back and forth and came to a consensus, I submitted our list. Wink, wink. Mm-hmm. I think at this point, you know, with the composite totals were somewhere in like the 200s, maybe up to 300. And you know, we're releasing them in increments of 25. No one in the first 50 rounds was represented on my list. I think finally we got one, the most recent release of, greatest WCW wrestlers, old Max Payne. I ranked at 99 out of 100. he finally landed in there in like the top 175 or so. But anyway, that will be
a note about Max Payne. Mm-hmm. Funny note about Max Payne. When I was skipping through Sold Out, I came across the Big Bubba and Hugh Morris match that we referenced earlier. And first looked at it, I didn't realize it was Hugh Morris. I thought it was Max Payne. And I had a moment.
Oh, God.
Max Payne was long gone from WCW by 97. Did they bring him in for one shot?
97, yeah.
And so I stopped. I had to stop to play the match. And then he turned around. I saw his face. And I was like, oh, it's Bill DeMott. It's Hugh Morris. There he is.
Mm.
It was Hugh Morris the whole time.
Well, I'm sure you guys will be thrilled to know that the subject of this episode of Talking WCW, Eddie Guerrero, I had at a cool number 16 on my top 100. So outside of that top 10, but still, that's a mighty healthy placement for him.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and I'll be showing even more love to at least one member of the Midnight Express who really crept his way up my list. But more on that next episode.
Ooh, okay. What about you, Greg? What you got going on?
Yeah, that'll do it for me, folks.
What do I have going on? People can follow me on Twitter if they'd like to at gphillips8652. No, I'm not changing it. You can follow me there for all of my hot takes on a variety of things, and you'll catch me talking about bops and LFGs and all kinds of things. But so you can do that if you'd like. Let me think if there's anything else that I've got to promote. Not really, no. If you know the secret to happiness in life, send that my way. if you have a large amount of cash you'd like to sit on, we can hook up on Twitter and we can discuss. There's a Nigerian guy that tried to get a few weeks ago, but I sent him some so he could wire it to me, and it hasn't gotten back to me.
Oh, shit. Well,
that's not going to work out well, I don't think. All right, well, so as for me, I have shows on pretty much all these networks that Tim just talked about. North South, I have TNA Never Dies, and the Extreme Three-Way Dance. We just had a new episode drop recently. It's very excellent, covering The Doctor Is In from 1996, a show that I rated very highly. And also on the Jenny Position, which is my podcast feed, I have an episode of Freak Out Drive-In, which me and my friend Rocco talked about Sleepaway Camp, so you should probably listen to that. And the newest you heard about Pluto is me and Andy Atherton talking about the Carol Burnett Show and watching a couple episodes of that on Pluto, so check that out. And I have a guest spot on that 90210 show very soon, and also recently.
Yes.
So yeah, that was like a 2-hour show about a 1-hour show. So
we had an extended tangent on President's Day and holidays in general, and yeah, it's.
One of the first Palm Springs, the first Palm Springs episode, so legendary,
right.
Of course. Listen to that if you like 90210, and all my shit is linked on Twitter and my Facebook page at Jenny Position. And I think that is it. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next
time. Can I raise one question before we go?
Of course, yes.
Please.
You mentioned the ECW show. And the title of The Doctor Is In for that show reminded me, we wouldn't be talking WCW if we didn't go off in different directions. So I want to pose it to you and to Tim a question, which I've never considered until now. With all of the mining of the past that WWE has done over the years, bringing back Halloween Havoc for NXT, bringing back the Great American Bash, even bringing back Starrcade at one point, why, since they own the intellectual property, why has WWE not named a pay-per-view Big Ass Extreme Bash?
Or The Doctor Is In, for that matter.
Yeah. Or any of the awesome names that WCW has.
I tell you my favorite. Where the hell is Born to Be Wired 2022?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
You're telling me we could get Great Balls of Fire, but not Born to Be Wired?
Not Born to Be Wired. Reborn.
Not Big Ass Extreme Bash.
Reborn to Be Wired. It is.
I like it. See, that's the kind of creative that they need right now, because Shane's gone.
Shane's gone. Who's gonna be there to pitch things like that with him gone?
Do I live in a world where I don't know the results to Double Tables 2016? What was the fake thing that Randy Orton had? It all goes back to wrestling.
Intermittent explosive disorder.
Yeah.
Holy shit, what?
It's not intermittent explosive disorder. It's just, I got too many.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it is or not, but that's what he said.
No, it totally is.
Is it really?
I mean, I feel it.
I'm going to look it up.
I always assume. Well, then Randy,
I have
thought about that.
Yeah.
I would assume.
Let me clarify. I would have said
Randy Orton calls me intermittent explosion.
Yeah!
All right, so intermittent IED. IED, intermittent explosive disorder.
I used to
think healthcare. It's a mental health disorder.
Wow! I always thought it was made up because of the initials IED.
DSM-5. DSM-5, DSM-4 diagnosis. I think it's a little bit controversial, but it's in here.